of all, this morning I should like to say how very happy I am to be here today. Increasingly, in recent years, I've heard more and more of this college and of the remarkable vitality that's at work here. So I was most happy some months ago to receive first from the president of the college and then from Professor Essig the invitation to come here this month to deliver the Binti Memorial Lecture. And when it was suggested that I should talk to you this morning about some major figure in the literary life of our time, it occurred to me that I should use this occasion to try to formulate some of the conclusions that I've been reaching lately as I've tried to reassess for myself to some degree the meaning and significance of the career of Ernest Hemingway. Increasingly, I've come to feel in recent years that this Tarzan-like figure, with the rugged outdoor grin and the hairy chest, who hunts lions in the African bush and who sits for ridiculous interviews with profile writers for The New Yorker, is one of the central and decisive protagonists in modern literary tradition. This is, to be sure, a judgment which others, amongst them many of the most discriminating critics of our time, had arrived at long ago. But as for myself, it is, as I say, a judgment at which I have arrived only in recent years. For given my own temperamental limitations, the public image of the man has always been at the furthest remove from the kind of human style which wins my admiration. And I have today lost none of my earlier impatience with the Hemingway legend. The sportsman, the chest-beating big game hunter, the hard-drinking, wise-cracking war correspondent, the dedicated aficionado, the champion of the rugged outdoor life. This is a figure whose pretensions, whose love of publicity, have represented for me only a kind of sorry vulgarity, and I am no less repelled by it today than I was in 1950 when I read Lillian Ross's famous New Yorker profile. But as I've gone through his books again in the last two or three years, I've begun to feel that it is some obscure compulsion that leads the man through all the absurd humbuggery and attitudinizing that leads the man to create a public image of himself that is thoroughly false to the sobriety and the honesty and the moral seriousness of his real vision. And these are indeed the particular qualities that give to his work the importance that I now feel it to have. Some years ago, Mr. Van Wyck Brooks, in the course of a long and angry diatribe against 20th century literature, spoke of Hemingway as a writer who, as he said, seems bent on proving that life is a dark little pocket and that only the ugly is real. And the remark itself, I think, is to be taken seriously only insofar as it affords a rather saddening evidence of the deterioration of what was once a very fine critical intelligence. But at least it may put us in mind of what we may have neglected to see, that like many of the other great artists of our time, like Conrad and Kafka and Faulkner and Penn Warren, Hemingway is not, like Mr. Van Wyck Brooks, a Pelagian, but is rather an Augustinian who believes that if there is a God, this living society of men is discarded from his presence. And whether there is or is not a God, believes that the human race is implicated in some terrible aboriginal calamity. And it is into these calamitous abysses made known by modern experience that Hemingway has looked with an intentness and honesty and a sobriety that begin now to make it possible, for me at least, to see in many of his books the grandeur of tragic vision. It is in many of the short stories that we get the most concentrated expressions of his sense of existence. And in none, I believe, do we get a quicker access to his basic perspective than in the story called A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. An old man is sitting on the terrace of a Spanish cafe, and as he sips his brandy, he is looked at and talked about by two waiters in the cafe. One waiter says, "Last week he tried to commit suicide." The other says, "Why?" "Oh, he was in despair." "What about?" "Nothing." "How do you know it was nothing?" "He has plenty of money." Then the old man asks for another drink and then for still another, but by now it's getting late, so the younger of the two waiters refuses to serve him. And after he leaves, the other waiter asks his younger associate why he turned the old man out. "Why didn't you let him stay and drink?" he asks. Well, the younger man says quite plainly that he has a wife at home in bed waiting for him, and on this particular night he's eager to return to her. Whereupon the unhurried waiter reminds him that they are going to be closing up then earlier than usual, and asks if he has no fear of getting home before the customary hour. "No," says the waiter, who's in a hurry, "I have confidence. I am all confidence." "Yes," says the older waiter, "you have youth, confidence, and a job. You have everything. And what do you lack?" The younger man, that is, asks the older man, "And what do you lack?" He says, "Everything but work." The younger man says,
You have everything I have.
No, says the older man, I have never had confidence, and I am not young. I am of those who like to stay late at the cafe. I am one with all those who do not want to go to bed, with all those who need a light for the night. Yes, says the older man, he likes to stay on at the cafe at night as long as possible, for this, he says to the younger man, this is a clean and pleasant cafe. It is well lighted. Then after the younger waiter leaves, the older man continues the conversation with himself. What did he fear? It was not fear or dread. It was a nothing that he knew too well. It was all a nothing, and a man was nothing too. It was only that, and light was all it needed, and a certain cleanness and order. Some lived in it and never felt it, but he knew it all was nada. Now here we have the obsession that is at the heart of all of Hemingway's most characteristic work. It is an obsession with the bleak and desolate vacuum that seems to be at the center of existence. It is an obsession with the despair, which is the primary sensation that gives life to the central personages of his fiction. The despair that is felt by the old patron, the despair that is felt by the elder waiter in this story. It is the despair that men know when they know the final reality of life to be nada, nothingness. And it is therefore a despair that murders sleep and that makes a man cling to a clean, well-lighted place when he has the good fortune to find one. Hemingway's world, says Ken Warren in the very fine essay that he has devoted to Farewell to Arms, Hemingway's world is the world we find pictured in Tennyson's In Memoriam, the world in which human conduct is a product of dying natures, earth and lime. It is the world pictured in Hardy and Hausmann, a world that seems to be presided over by blind doomsters. It is the world of Zola, or Dreiser, or Conrad, or Faulkner. It is, says Ken Warren, the world of secular hurryings through space. The God abandoned world, the world with nothing at center. Now, the persistent problem to which Mr. Hemingway has addressed himself for more than 30 years has been the problem of finding a discipline by the adherence to which a man's spirit and character might be sufficiently strengthened to enable him not only to endure, but also finally himself to prevail over this nadaistic anarchy. This is, I believe, in the very first instance, the moral and religious significance of the very manner in which he presents his vision.
the Hemingway style, of course, is by now so widely known and so famous that we need not undertake any close and lengthy analysis of it. It suffices to say that it's a highly colloquial style, which makes a great point of avoiding the grand flourish, the involuted statement, the diction, the syntax never carry even the barest traces of ornamentation. Everything has about it an almost aggressively non-literary air. His sentences march along in a tersely telegraphic fashion, being generally of the simple declarative sort, sometimes being comprised of two simple independent clauses which are joined together by a conjunction. But only very rarely do his sentences involve any subordination of dependent clauses. And the prose that these sentences make up is a hard, clean, crisp, clear prose, unpadded by even the merest suggestion of embellishment or of dramatic gesticulation. It is, of course, to be remembered that in the years immediately before and immediately after the First World War, Mr. Hemingway earned his living as a newspaper reporter. And as many years later, he was to say of this period in his life, in his book of 1932, Death in the Afternoon, "In writing for a newspaper," as he put it in that book, "you told what happened, and with one trick or another, you communicated the emotion aided by the element of timeliness, which gives a certain emotion to any account of something that has happened on that day. But the real thing, the sequence of motion and fact which made the emotion, and which would be as valid in a year or 10 years, or with luck, and if you stated it purely enough, always, the real thing, was beyond me, and I was working very hard to get it." What he had wanted to learn to do, as he said in this book, was to write without tricks, and without cheating, with nothing, as he put it, that will go bad afterwards. And at the technological level, at the level of craft, of mechanics, this involved an intense objectivism. This involved a ruthless disengagement on the part of the writer from his material, so that events, instead of being reordered and analyzed by the authorial intelligence, might be simply exhibited in the brutal gratuitousness which constituted their real, their immediate actuality. Here, for example, is a passage that occurs towards the end of "The Sun Also Rises." Let me read it. "Downstairs, we came out through the first floor dining room to the street. A waiter went for a taxi. It was hot and bright. Up the street was a little square with trees and grass where there were taxis parked. A taxi came up the street, the waiter hanging out at the side. I tipped him and told the driver where to drive and got in beside Brick. The driver started up the street. I settled back. Brett moved close to me. We sat close against each other. I put my arm around her and she rested against me comfortably. It was very hot and bright, and the houses looked sharply white. We turned out on to the Grand Via. "Oh, Jake," Brett said, "we could have had such a damn good time together." Ahead was a mounted policeman in khaki directing traffic. He raised his baton. The car slowed suddenly, pressing Brett against me. "Yes," I said, "isn't it pretty to think so?" Now, what is significant in this passage is that the emphasis is on the purely factual, on the bare statement of happenings, of situations. No effort is made to reach beneath the events and the situation. Everything that is said simply by showing the surface alone, by showing the seemingly irrelevant flow of trivial chatter, the incoherent flux of external facts. And yet, after we contemplate this passage, we discover that the miracle here is that by what has apparently been just an aimless chronicle of facts, of external detail, there has been a marvelous concentration into this brief passage of the whole meaning of "The Sun Also Rises." And this is indeed, one feels, that real thing which Hemingway, as he said in Death in the Afternoon, began to search for early in his career. Namely, a realism which by its very intensity would be transformed into a kind of symbolism. That is to say, he wanted to scrutinize the details of modern existence with such rigorousness and with such reserve that the realism of the style would convert itself into a symbolic expression of the human style, by means of which a man might endure and possibly even triumph over the indifference of the world. The man, in other words, who, in the chilly, laconic language of the early stories and of "The Sun Also Rises" and "A Farewell to Arms," the man who renders the winter of life in the modern age with such impassiveness, with such neutrality, is a man who wants at least to survive the despair of a God-abandoned world without being paralyzed by terror and without surrendering that poise, that self-containment, which he takes to be the real mark of our human dignity. He does not want to let that go. And his way of managing this little triumph is simply to be attentive to what happens. That is, to look and to notice and to report with no glossing of the facts, with no fancy emotion, with no grumbling, with no evaluation. He simply looks, notices, reports. The facts, in their one by one discreteness, are simply faced and reported. And the purse understatement of the style, juxtaposed against the deep unhappiness and frustration which the style reports, provides, as Professor Mark Shorer has observed, provides the perfect measurement of what Shorer calls that peculiar morality of the stiff lip, which is Hemingway's characteristic method of dealing with the vicissitudes of modern life. So this is what I mean when I speak of the moral and religious dimension of the style itself. And this is what Mr. Philip Young has in mind when, in his brilliant book on Hemingway, he says, the intense simplicity of the prose is a means by which the man says, things must be made simple or I am lost. The impersonal tone speaks of the need to escape personality. The objectivity exists because subjectivity could mean that a brain could get to racing like a flywheel with the weight gone. The economy of the prose masters the little it can control cleanly. The style is unemotional, is primitive, because it has to be. And it says so. So then, in a way, one might say that Hemingway's subject is his style. And the style is the subject. And thus far, I have been defining his subject by way of defining the style. But let me now turn more directly to the subject itself. And like the style, this is something also that has to do with a discipline, with a code. For just as the anarchy of our human universe is subduable by the artist only by means of a discipline, so too is it also subduable by the personages of Hemingway's fiction only by means of a strict discipline or code. And this is, one might say, a code that in its own way is just as primitive as the artist's style itself. The principal rules of the code are honesty and courage. The principal taboos are fickleness and incompetence and funking out. To be admirable from the standpoint of this morality is to admit deceit, to be a good sportsman, to accept pain without an outcry, to adhere strictly to the rules of the game, and to play the game with skill. To be repugnant, to be contemptible, is to violate any of these requirements. It is a sportsmanlike morality, or equally, you might say, it is the morality of sportsmanship which extends its requirements even into the region of manners and carriage. One must speak in clipped tones. One must avoid pretentious phrases. One must condense emotion into a few expletives, or perhaps even better, one must deliberately suppress emotion altogether. And I think you might well divide all of Hemingway's men into those, on the one hand, who master the code, and those, on the other hand, who show themselves unable to live up to the code. An excellent example of the latter type is the central character in the short story called The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber. It is true, of course, that under the guidance of the hunter, Wilson, McComber does gradually manage to acquire the essential virtues. But when we first meet him, he is a man who has failed all the crucial tests. For example, on a hunting expedition in the African bush, he has run away from a charging lion. And as Wilson, his guide, explains to him, this is something that one simply does not do. No white man ever bolts, he says. And not only has McComber turned heel in the face of a charging lion, but what is more, he asks Wilson to conceal the fact and not to talk about it to anyone else. And this is the grossest bad form. At least having run away from the charging lion, he might have shut up about it. Then after Wilson berates him, he commits the further faux pas of apologizing. Nor is this the end of his indiscretions. In the course of this safari, another lion is tracked down. And after it is badly wounded by McComber, the lion runs back into the tall grass to lie in wait for the hunter. And of course, this last stage of the hunt becomes exceedingly dangerous business, and McComber would like to avoid it. Indeed, he proposes to Wilson that the native boys, who are inadequately armed, that they be sent in after the animal. And when Wilson says that this would be tantamount to slaughter, and says that he'll have no part of it, McComber then suggests that they simply leave the beast in the grass. But this is a tack than which there could be none worse for him to take, because of course if the animal is left in the grass, someone else might stumble on him unawares and be killed. And even should this not happen, the lion is in great pain. And it would be the worst sort of callousness for a hunter, after having wounded him, to go off and leave him to die only after protracted agony. So as Wilson forces McComber to realize there's simply nothing left to do but to go in after the lion and finish the job. But then when they do finally track him down, McComber loses his nerve and runs in panic, leaving Wilson to kill the charging beast. Now, to be sure, as I say, in the course of the story, McComber does at last learn how to behave decently, how to behave with honor and courage in an extreme situation. But my point is that throughout most of the story, he represents the kind of sloppy messiness of character, which is for Hemingway the inevitable result of a man's failure to internalize within himself that code of conduct by which alone we can be ourselves rescued from the messiness of life itself. So Macumber is an example of those who fail to live up to the code. And in this, he is not unlike Robert Cohn in The Sun Also Rises, who does not admit defeat with the lady whom he loves and who, when he is hurt by her, lets everyone know about it. But then in The Sun Also Rises, the messiness of a Robert Cohn is to be contrasted with the expertise of the young matador, Romero, who symbolizes the kind of integrity that can be achieved when one's own life is carefully codified. And of course, in Hemingway's mythology, it is the boring, where of all places, it is least possible to get away with faking, with cheating, and where, amidst the naked threat of violent death, a man's stuff is put to the crucial test and is revealed as either genuine or false. Here, for example, is his picture of perfect integrity. He says, and he's describing Romero's technique in the ring, he says, Romero never made any contortions. Always it was straight and pure and natural in line. The others twisted themselves like corkscrews. Afterward, all that was fake turned bad. But Romero's bullfighting gave real emotion because he kept the absolute purity of line. Since the death of Yoselito, all the bullfighters had been developing a technique which simulated this appearance of danger in order to give a fake emotional feeling while the bullfighter was really safe. But Romero had the old thing, the holding of his purity of line. And it is in the completeness with which Romero's humanity has been steeled by a difficult and dangerous discipline that Hemingway would have us behold an image of that by which alone we can resist the subversive power of nada. Discipline. Discipline. The code. Now it is, I think, in the light of this doctrine of discipline that we are expected to appraise old Santiago, the hero of Mr. Hemingway's last novel, The Old Man and the Sea. In this magnificently simple story of a great and simple man and of his incredible stamina before the assault and the vicissitudes of the sea, we have what is perhaps Hemingway's finest image of the the human voyager. Here in old Santiago's quest of the big marlin, and in his brave struggle to bring the fish back to the shore, we have an archetypal image of man facing the precariousness of existence with the only armor, with the only weapon that it is possible for him to face it with, namely the invincibility of his own courage. And in the greatness of this old fisherman's fortitude and bravery, we have, I think Hemingway would say, we have the only kind of evidence that we shall ever have to support the faith that man will ultimately prevail. Now, to be sure, Santiago does not succeed in getting the fish back to the shore. But the point is that he's not really beaten. For, in the first place, he kills the fish well. He does not, that is to say, betray the discipline of his craft. Nor does he betray the great discipline that his human dignity enjoins him to practice. For in the gallantry of his struggle with the fish, in the gallantry of it, he hurls back at the cruel indifference of the world the answer that it is man's genius to voice, that there will be no wheedling complaint, no self-pity, no surrender. So, though this old man is situated in a world that is a kind of trap, he yet emerges triumphant from the pressure of his ordeal. And Hemingway offers the example of his heroism as an example of that in the strength of which man can alone rest his confidence that he will ultimately survive the difficulties of this life. Indeed, we might say that in old Santiago, we have Hemingway's image of the saint. For in him, we behold the human spirit steeled against the cruelties of this world by a martial discipline, by a martial code. Though for this old man and for the Hemingway hero generally, life is a contest, and the world is to be approached as a kind of antagonist, we yet feel in Santiago, as I think in many of Hemingway's other heroes, we yet feel a certain natural piety. We are told, for example, that the old man, and I quote, was very fond of flying fish, that they were his principal friends on the sea, and we are also told that he was sorry for the birds, especially the small, delicate terns that were always flying and looking and almost never finding. And he thought, old Santiago, the birds have a harder life than we do, except for the robber birds and the heavy, strong ones. Why did they make birds so delicate and fine as those sea swallows? Why did they make birds so delicate and fine when the ocean can be so cruel? And we are told that after he hooks the great fish, he pities him, and wonders if the fish has had any plans, and if he is as desperate as he is himself. This is, I say, a kind of piety that we feel in the old fisherman, and it is something that we have often previously encountered in Hemingway's heroes. It's something that we encounter in many of the stories, and in books like The Sun Also Rises and The Farewell to Arms and For Whom the Bell Tolls. He often makes us feel, to put it very colloquially, that for him, the great blasphemy is dishonesty, is doing dirt on life. The great blasphemy is contempt for the good and the holy. But I cannot agree with Professor Carlos Baker when, beyond the natural piety, he goes on to maintain in his book on Hemingway that, as he puts it, the consciousness of God is in Hemingway's books. And he tells us that the Book of Common Prayer is seldom far out of Hemingway's reach. Now, of course, on this latter point, Professor Baker is better informed than I am. And it may be that Hemingway does have some old affection for the Anglican prayer book. Of this I have no knowledge, I have no information. But though it is true, as Professor Baker rightly insists, that Hemingway is neither a moral nor a metaphysical nihilist, his work in no way justifies, however, so far as I can see, the implication that at bottom it is essentially Christian. No, on the contrary, when we reach that ultimate depth of Hemingway's vision, we find it to be, as I have been wanting to suggest this morning, we find it to be a vision that, like that of many of the other great writers of the modern period, is a vision that is essentially stoical. I sometimes feel that the one real rival, the one real competitor that Christianity has in the modern period is Stoicism. For Hemingway, life is a kind of trap in which a man is bound to be beaten, in which a man is bound at last to be destroyed, but yet a man may emerge triumphant in his full human stature if he manages to keep his chin up. And like Conrad and Malraux and Camus, the moral and religious effort that Hemingway's books embody is the effort of trying to define that discipline by the adherence to which a man may succeed in keeping his chin up and in retaining his human dignity despite the assaults upon it of an indifferent world. In other words, his final concern is, like Faulkner's, with the cost of endurance, with the cost of endurance, and with the means by which man may prevail. And the only grace of which Hemingway knows anything is that natural benignity of the human spirit itself, at which a man arrives when, through the enabling power of an ethical discipline, he has somehow managed to survive the pressures, the ordeals of experience. And this, I submit, is a very modern, a very characteristic type of vision in the literary life of our time.